Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Steve Brown. Tonight we have a reading presented by the Poetry Reading Series at the College of General Studies and co-sponsored by the Boston University Center for the Humanities. Our speakers are Irish poets Sinead Morrissey and Mary O'Donohue. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Boston University Associate Professor of Humanities, Meg Tyler.
Tonight we have the great fortune of listening to two dazzling writers, Mary O'Donohue and Sinead Morrissey. Both hail from the same island, O'Donohue from County Clare, Morrissey from County Armagh. Both, because of their accuracy, both visual and aural, take a mathematical delight in language and the impressive and intricate forms that can be raised from the never simple act of plotting out words on a page. Both are highly accomplished craftspeople and make evident a love for the particular. So Mary O'Donohue will read first, and then Sinead Morrissey, and I will introduce them both briefly. Mary O'Donohue is in every way a local poet. Local to Boston, local to Tuscaloosa, local to Ireland, local to poetry and to prose alike. Her prose is so much like her poetry, each sentence an adventure of the idiosyncratic. Here is her description of a house on fire. There was no fight against this fire. It was powerful enough to heat the pine and perfume the woods like something that could anesthetize you. The smell still spun in the morning air. It had leaped and danced and preened and ate the little wooden house like a feast. Like the fire, the house, each simile consumes the previous one, growing the conflagration. There is something of the fairy tale in this passage, so when we encounter a poem like Blizzard, we are not surprised to read, "We tamp the glacier's skin, feel for the feeble of the river's pulse. A tiny lost mitten is a pink shock on the path. Your cheeks fulfill fairy tales, rose red's rude health, or the pricked finger blood of Snow White's mother." At times the poems lean towards storytelling, the prose towards something imagistically potent. Hers is a dual art, her quicksilver tongue ever finding gold. I welcome Mary O'Donohue.
Meg, thank you for that extraordinary introduction. I don't recognize a lot of it, but it's good to be surprised and also to be hosted here at this venue where I have attended many, many poetry events and other readings. And I'm delighted to be reading with Sinead this evening, whose work I admire tremendously. I suppose I will be local and range across the forms tonight. This poem is called The Devonian Period. It imagines a possible geological time when the north of Europe was connected to America. And it's a poem for my mother. I haven't read it in a long time, and the book just opened at this one, perhaps because I will be seeing her in another couple of months. The Devonian Period. 1. The luggage trolley veers left, further left, skids and judders on its rubber wheels, a curveting horse on linoleum, as she steers it past the milk glass airport doors that meet and seal behind her. She is small and big-eyed as a child, flushed, stalled amid the savvy and rush of arrivals. She navigates the babble-full hall. Babies parceled in anoraks are handed to grandparents. Girlfriends cradle cellophaned roses. We meet. I am 5'5½". Her nose meets the notch in my collarbone. 2. That week, we breakfast on brown bread sliced tombstone thick. The bread, she's sure, of my wildest, most diasporic desires. We link arms on the train, chat to our hollow-faced reflections in the dark window, wince at the pain of brakes sounding, rounding oxbow turns, crooked elbows along the track. 3. Through a slice of open door, we hear a ribbon of chimpanzee screams, It's a raccoon seething with rabies, grey belly heaving like a fat, furred heart between branches. The drop of something through the dark, a pouch full, its soft fall and settle in the high grass. 4. My temper, she knows, is less igneous now, slower to heat and erupt, cooling off quickly to leave me stone-faced, impassive, surveying the topography she unrolls, carpet-wise, chaotic in my house. Anarchic bedclothes, a festoonery of jewellery that mocks my one neat box, the origami of receipts crushed in pockets and purses, longer hairs scrawling cursive things in the sink. Our ways are crusted into us. Without even thinking, I dab a crumb from the corner of her mouth, and blinking, hugely blue, maram-lashed, she lets me. I think I'll read one or two of the poets whose work I translate. And I'll start with the poet Louis de Puer. He's a Cork poet, as is another poet that you'll hear in a moment. This poem is called Gramadoc. It means grammar. It makes reference to An Gúm, which is a body, a state body in Ireland for producing Irish educational materials, dictionaries, translations, musical scores, many, many texts. Gramadoc. Níor honig do chaint leat fós, ná níl éin corvus ina haef san earth. Quirin bríhra sna tríhí tú, is an mó ar dhíhac, ní múr ná go dachtan le grán, dúsig, cuddl, dén, ná dén, bí. Tá do verlagar féin agat, réif úr laura a higach dúrámon nú an tiongolí féin le heimsir. Strias, strank, scrad, gnúsacht, manfach, tost, gur léir don illa a bhrí ilíach. Grammar. You can't talk yet, and you're not too put out about that. Words send you into convulsions, especially verbs. The imperative mood is the funniest thing you've ever heard. Wake up. Go asleep. Do. Don't. Be. You have your own lingo any fool could understand, even a linguist given time. Grin. Yowl. Gurn. Yawn. Grunt. Silence that makes perfect sense to everyone. Tán tú condera de réir cártica na nocturi, na sanoliha linv lanabí. Ach, má hogan tú lát, mar is boilach de dúrhig, irid focal is tá rílacha gramair I lauerlana an gúm. Ní dérfig tú éin ní, gur fiú éin ní in éin cor é, hara méid, a daulamish in Oregon na brinna, punkiocht do goira drim ash, the acleana na farina id yor. You're behind schedule according to the doctor's charts, the childish child experts. But if you learn, and I'm afraid you will, as many words as there are rules of grammar in the libraries of An Gúm, you won't say a blessed thing worth anything more than what you've already learned in the womb's elocution room. The punctuation of laughter back to front, the declension of rain into tears. Colum Branach is another Irish language poet from Cork. I'm quite new to translating his work. I've greatly admired it for a long time. But it's quite a different thing to be presented with this poet's work that I so admire. Also knowing that he's a terminologist with the Department of Education in Ireland and a translator with the government. So you're highly imperiled as a translator. But he's been very generous. This poem is called An Fear Maireamh. The Blasket Islands off the coast of Kerry, which I'm sure many of you know, there are six of them. And the most northerly of them is Inis Tuaiscirt, otherwise known as the Dead Man or the Sleeping Giant. And If you haven't seen it before, I recommend looking at a picture of it. You'll see. And these islands were inhabited until the early 1950s, completely Irish-speaking. And when they were no longer inhabited, its people, many of them moved to Dingle, where they could look out. And on a fair day, as they say, on a clear day, they could see the dead man. And Brannock takes the island to do his particular work with in this poem. On Fairmarv. Tá Fairmarv agus na hainne ina lí ar a ad is ar a lahad a mwy ar ír na spéra. Ilan ná tugtar tros ar níos a bhó, bál ná tráctar harris tríd an gió, ná siúltar ná chónarí ar, sa tóir ar chuimhní gur dóichí ná a bhalart go dítidir le fáil fadó. The dead man. Every one of us has a dead man lying stretched along the horizon, an island never visited anymore, a foggy place never mentioned, its paths unwalked in search of memories, a place that probably toppled over the cliff ages ago. Tá Ilan Mara Fada Orth agus na hainne Sinta Imal an Coasa. Go dagan a cúriocht gorcha idir iad agus leas le lin don ngrain dul fé. Mae mal, mora wilaun, ach asling miawl is tír na nóg in a scalp chioi. I brasil, mar ish merahil. Tugim go vil ilan aun, imil vord mo vahasa. O hosnig arish an taum taresh the voice. May mal, maybe, just a mirage. Tirna nog, a bank of fog, a glancing vision like high Brasil. I know there is such an island off the coastline of my own life, since time began all over again after your death. O chalig tu a irverev, ta tu idilon shinta ir namara. Agus tá inal á eistú i Mosca na Voiga is an tíada i gáil von na cé i Maróig agus fear an bhóid hís ag fógart gur mihid domsa teacht bord. Since you died, dead man, you have been an island laid out along the edge of the Atlantic, and there's an engine being fitted in a coracle as the tide clutches the edge of the quay, and the ferryman below announces it's time for me to board. I have a short story. It sounds like it's just folded up in my pocket. I have a short story. And when I say short, this one is short. I write fiction in, I suppose, varying lengths, but when I read, I don't tend to prevail on people for too long. And you've already been so kind, why would I ruin it, right? Why would I do that? This story is called Samoan Parakeet. It is, I suppose, interested, as they say, in impairment. And you'll hopefully see what shapes that takes in the story. And I try to disrupt form to get at the impairments I am interested in here. It's set in Galway, especially along the seaside. The part of Galway that's called Salt Hill, which is both a lovely and kind of trashy place. There's a hotel there, and I know that you know the one I'm talking about. There's a hotel that's been closed down for maybe 30 years, the Burren Mount, and yet it has not been knocked to the ground. I don't know why. It's very sinister looking. It's there, and it appears in this. And there's also Claude's, which is a gaming arcade. I'm very interested in arcades, and they make kind of brief appearances, I think, in my work. Anyhow, this one is real as well. Claude's, the Burren Mount, the part of Galway called Salt Hill. Samoan Parakeet. A window wave flittered from his wife, the mini roundabout taken, fast and tidy. Her car, a bright orange bead in the curved traffic mirror. His own, long gone back to the company. The morning, cold and opening, wide to receive the day's vulnerabilities. Their girl pulling his arm harder this morning. Fourth morning to walk the prom. Again, the diving board. Again, no. Big yellow concrete platform facing east. Already a cluttered catwalk. Teenagers hanging off one another. Lankiness and paleness and flags of sunburn. A grope before the plunge. A dolphin knocking around those waters last year. No time to read the papers back then, now giving anything to know what happened, that dolphin. That other dolphin down in Dingle for 30 years. Fun-loving little f***, getting photographed with Pierce Brosnan and even one of the Kennedys. The platform teenagers swallow diving to the water, sculptures for a moment. Ungainly and their gawky selves back on sand. Then up the platform to do it all over again. Hauled harder by her. Reel her back from traffic slapping past. Always a shock, her granite. His brother in the girder set of her shoulders. No. No platform. Not their thing this morning. Will they walk? Just walk. Wouldn't that be grand? Nearly strong enough to flip him up and over. Tilt a whirl. Young couple going by, getting told they're in love, they must be having a baby. Kissing her big thing lately. Barbie and the man doll in a permanent clinch on the desk, from here to eternity. Barbie on top. The young couple smiling sympathy, the way most people did. Failure of the imagination, could hardly recall the time before they were told the situation. Never mind a time when she never was. His wife, an adjuster, an adapter, always been, making the best of their lot. Last time of calling was acne. Neck and cheeks flaring most terribly. Her back, prescriptions sought and painted on, telling their girl salicylic acid, supposed to do wonders. Muslin mittens found to help night scratching. Could never imagine a skinny teen in their kitchen, a girl aglow with sun rudeness and some lad's hands. Only ever two conversations about having another better one next time. His wife wondering. Second time his suggestion, quashed as selfish. Walking all the tighter to her, daring passers-by. Look longer. Go on then. On to hell. He'd be happy, oh, more than, to punch their lights out. His wife not like that at all. Pride in her bearing when they all walked out together. The tone set. Their girl treated as such. Not sweat billowing when she lunged up from watching telly. Not scabs. Not the gerbil tickled to death. His imagination miscarrying, keeping account of these things. The diving platform well behind them now. Rockbarton West, San Antonio Terrace, boys on corners thumbing phones, the Atlantic Bar and Kilorans, walking at a fast clip, sinister windows of the Burren Mount, filthy net curtains, rumours of Eastern European teenagers. Closed, it must be years now, but still that air of stuff asked for and forcings behind the big windows. Dampness must be something awful. A mystery why the wrecking ball hadn't been sent through its dark arteries. Claude's. No way he'd sidetrack her past its bulbs. In she wanted and in she insisted. That parakeet's feathers still in her head. Claude's, perfumed with last night's bingo. Dustiness and rose. The teddy bear machine, that claw never catching grip, supposedly a knack, Joggle the joystick imperceptibly, patience as the bear is craned along, the drop short. Rigged like every last thing in arcades. Further in, teenagers eating floss, drifting. The Fridgeheim machines clinking and purring and tricking over. The Samoan parakeet near the back. Narrower, taller than other machines. Gummy buttons. Whose hands last? Who played with elbows tucked tight? The naked parakeet, black like a glove. Pin every flying feather back in place. Blue and green and red, cycloning and scattering to the edges. Each a different size and value. Orderliness, the order of the day. Patience. One bird eye rolling to the corners most sinisterly. Piddly half point for fixing it in place. A squawk. Got on your... Dead days dedicated to this misery in every corner of clods. Tried to be indispensable with Pentium processors. Suffered the commute and the long shifts. Packed 40 hours into 2.5 days. Stopped in Gort, halfway home. Middling pints, good toasted sandwiches. Docked just as his wife was leaving. Off to playgrounds all over on Friday afternoons. Off to films. Shrek and Despicable Me. This his third empty summer. DVDs. Cloudy with a chance of meatballs. Summer to come up with a plan for her. 12 now. Convinced her she wasn't dying when her first blood spread on a McDonald's seat. Young, they said. Her physical development in keeping with menstruation, though. Joking me, in keeping. His heart roaring. Not ready for such a thing. Eyes avoiding the chest in her school jumper. Heavy as turnips. Tried indispensable. Then any old thing to hold on. Demotion. The warehouse. Laughed at by pups from Castle Troy and Ennis. Good luck. Mind the door. No such thing as a foothold these days. No such thing as turning up and staying on. Gone with his father's days. Anything for a beer in his hand while dressing the parakeet. Pluming. Plumaging. Befeathering. Now a full wing on the parakeet. No effort from her, though. Again, just watching. Crooning approval when feathers got pinned faster. Try it, wouldn't she? No hope. Worth encouraging, though. Online, all the parents saying, expect the best, work towards the best. Bring her hands to the joystick. Hope for a revelation. Delight in a thing done right. A look on her face telling him hell. Pulling back with a wail. Wanting him to make the parakeet whole. Bright as one of Liberace's outfits. Feathers to snap and tack before the clock runs down. Get done with this for good and ever. Get out onto the prom again. Maybe walk the way back to town. Sea road. The Cladda. Boats loitering for action. Hulls green and stinking until that rising tide they talked about floated every boat. Talk now about the Pentium plant being taken over by Big Pharma. Talk about new jobs. Talk. What about an ice cream? Sitting at the massive red flower boxes outside the museum. What about a pink little dainty at the French cafe? The new playground by the cathedral. The red-haired buskers. The big knitted tree at the library. All day. Really, they had. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. It's lovely to finally have you here to read. Sinead Morrissey's poem, Baltimore, from her book Parallax, begins, "In other noises, I hear my children crying." A mother's ear is so practiced that she can pick the notes of her children's voices out of a concert of sounds, even when the children are not there. It is the sound she is always waiting or anticipating to hear. Morrissey is able to pull music out of things we might not ordinarily listen into for poems. As she writes elsewhere, "The wind and its instruments were my secret teachers." Although her range is astonishing, she writes movingly of motherhood, of the paralyzing fear parents feel when a child is ill, the way our nighttime listening becomes a form of straining, a contest of the ear. Was that a cough? Was that the last cough? Is he still breathing? The forms she works in continually shift, the architecture of each poem different from the last, and each a complement to what is being sung. Beautifully turned and beautifully tuned, her language layers each page like silk. I welcome Sinead Morrissey.
I'm going to begin with a find poem, otherwise known as a stolen poem. It's lifted from the contents page of the York Mystery Place. What I was struck by reading the contents page was how the different guilds in the city who were performing a biblical story in York, how they tried to match the activity of the guild to the activity of the Bible story. York. The plasterers, the creation. The card makers, the creation of Adam and Eve. The fullers, Adam and Eve in Eden. The armourers, the expulsion. The shipwrights, the building of the ark. The fishers and mariners, the flood. The parchment makers and bookbinders, Abraham and Isaac. The pewterers and founders, Joseph's trouble about Mary. The tile thatchers, the nativity. St. Leonard's hospital, the purification. The vintners, the marriage at Cana. The cappers, the woman taken in adultery. The bakers, the last supper. The cord winners, the agony in the garden and the betrayal. The Bowers and Fletchers, Christ before Annas and Caiaphas. The tapeters and couchers, the dream of Pilate's wife. The butchers, the death of Christ. The cooks and water letters, the remorse of Judas. The tailors, the ascension, the potters, Pentecost, and episodes in between with a yet more fabulous cohabiting, the woolpackers and woolen weavers, the Assumption of the Virgin, the spurriers and lorimers, Christ and the doctors, the spicers, the Annunciation, and, because even a singing gash in the stratosphere is redeemable, the fall of man to the repairers of barrels, buckets and tubs. Shadows. My shadow this morning on the station platform looks impossibly stretched and beaten thin. A stilt walker's shadow, all legs and no torso, a dun metal casing left after a hammering. Late February sunlight, winter's filigree still inside it. Beside me, the bins are casting vast apparitions of themselves over the yellow line. while my head has lain itself down across the tracks the way it wanted to all those years ago in Amsterdam near the Leidesplein, before the see-through boy with his quiver of arrows could claim me as his own. It jolts bolt upright as the Carrickfergus train vanishes in the opposite direction. I could be a dissident in a textbook in Soviet Russia, discovered after the print run and painstakingly blackened out by each teacher, or a stage set after the lights have blown on a tinkly Victorian performance in reds and golds. I could be blood in a black and white video. The platform is shining with salt. My shadow, displaced at the waist, is taking a bow. Lady other, lady mine, if I stood here all morning, I'd watch you retracting back like drowning soap. Shadows of candles on church walls at evensong, manifest not as flame, but smoke. Before my son could speak or even understand language, I would look at him in the back seat of the car and we were driving, and he would have lapsed into what my grandmother used to call a brown study. So he'd have gone somewhere, I don't know where, and it made me wonder what we think about before we have language, before we have words to put our thoughts into. And I took him to the zoo when he was one, and it was a complete failure as a trip, because I realised that for zoos to be successful, you need to have divided the world into the extraordinary and the ordinary. And he hadn't made that division yet. So I took him to see an elephant, but he was more interested in the hedge in front of the elephant's enclosure. Augustine sleeping before he can talk. The only places he can dive to are the senses. The Christmas lights his father dangled from the corners of his ceiling in July are his palimpsest for the world. A winking on and off of a bullying colour, unnamed and so untamed, to be committed to memory and then written over. For now, the world is simply to be crawled into like the sea, of which he has no fear. A bubbling, transmogrifying, all-attracting mechanism that has not yet disappointed with the mean-spirited vanishing act of an ink-black horizon. He has already learned how the tongue contains more mystery than the granite hulk of an elephant swaying suddenly into focus under the dank and knotted overhang of Cave Hill, tossing straw onto its shoulders to keep itself warm because it still, and tragically, remembers Africa. That when he opens his mouth to admit the spoon, anything can happen, from passion fruit to parmesan. The three tributary sounds of his name that flow as one, as though summer's hottest month had a feminine ending. He knows, and the purring of cats and cars and the howling of dogs and fireworks. His fingers adjust the tufts of the sheep's wool coat he lies on in his sleep. Tomorrow I'll offer him the dent of a worry stone and the fluted sticky centres of acacia flowers. All this can only be where he goes. There can be no other possibility, unless we accept that memory begins in the womb or back still further in the undiscovered bourn poor Hamlet dreamed of entering without map or compass as a deliverance from the sight of our back garden in September, the apple tree keeled over and cankered and the fuchsia disrobed. If he ever bombs inside a swimming pool or deep sea dives or moonwalks, if he ever moves from balancing on some underwater floor precariously filled with air to pressing off on the balls of his feet into his own ascent through a dense and illegible element, he may remember what it felt like to wake when he was one, and that it was a slow, alert surfacing towards the morning, the clock's face, the seagulls and the sea's address, all clamouring to be experienced. I'd like to read a poem called Electric Edwardians. There was two enterprising businessmen called Mitchell and Kenyon, and when film was a very new technology, they had the great idea of filming people and then setting up a makeshift cinema in the town where they lived at a fair and charging everybody a penny to come and see themselves on the screen. And unwittingly, they left behind a fantastically complete portrait of Edwardian life in Britain about 1900. And because they were making money, one of the popular types of films that they made were called factory gate frames. And they would go to the north of England and set up their Nordenograph camera, which was a static stable camera, outside the gates of mill factories. And they captured as many as 6,000 people in 10 minutes. So this is about their factory gate films. Electric Edwardians. They're here to make money, the men distinguished from the crowds they move among by white hats and walking sticks, to capture as many people as possible for their fairground bioscope shows. Come see yourselves on the screen as living history. And history sets up its Nordenograph and rolls and vacuums in the girls in shawls, the men and boys in caps, the entire rollicking sea of spinners and doffers and little tenters departing the factory gates at six like a nation's exodus. Everyone wears clogs. Everyone has a dinner to get to. But the dock of a quarter day's pay for a minute of horseplay is no longer over their heads, and so they jostle momentarily, blurred face by blurred face, to smile or to bow for the transmission of grace in the space near the cinematographer, as though the camera cast out a fraught pool of light in exchange for their imprint and they are standing in it. The women loiter less. A handful of men doff caps, then laugh, or shake incredibly wide white handkerchiefs at whoever may prove their witness. Themselves, their wives, coal miners, tram conductors, Boer War veterans, Lloyd George in the wings, who knows, the king, not to mention the unthinkable yet to be born. Not to mention me. And always, in every factory gate frame, like an offering up of driftwood out of the indeterminate mass after its comb and polish, or the crystallization of salt from a smoky suspension, children linger longest in the foreground, shoving, lampooning, breaking the line, or simply staring back at us across the lens's promise, as though we still held Passchendaele in our pockets and could find a way to save them. They grin and grin, not yet, not yet, while in a corner of the screen a cart horse stumbles, flickers, flashes into darkness where the cellulose nitrate stock rubbed off inside the milk churn. I was brought up by dedicated communists in Belfast, and hardly anyone was a dedicated communist in Belfast, especially not in the 1970s and 80s. I think there's dramatically less now. But every Christmas we had to go to the Communist Party Christmas Bazaar, bizarrely, which was held in the church hall above Rosemary Street Presbyterian Church. So this is about that. The Party Bazaar. Ingrid in her shawls, been here since nine. burdening the tables on loan from the church downstairs with babushka dolls and caviar, handkerchiefs and wine from Yugoslavia, Bulgarian perfume. My brother and I ask for a job and are handed pink and white posters of peace and détente to decorate the room. It's trickier than we thought to stick them straight, so secretly we give up. Almost everyone's smoking. In the background, Kalinka on cassette, belted out by the Red Army Choir, wobbles towards its peak. There's tea, coffee, Irish stew, and a cool display of anti-Mrs. Thatcher paraphernalia. Pens in the shape of nails for her coffin we'll buy and use in school. Shop stewards come, and sympathisers who once a year, like Christians, demonstrate their faith. The odd, bewildered, lured-in shopper looking for soap or socks. But mostly it's just us, card carriers and the kids thereof, filling up the air with fevered talk. By four, Rosemary Street's ablaze in the solstice dark. We pack what's left of the wooden trains and vodka into crates for another year and repair to the Duke of York, where once an actual Soviet representative, tall, thin, in frost-inflected English, gave a speech, and I clutched my lemonade and was convinced. And staying with Russia, I have lots of poems about Russia. This is a book inspired by the Moscow Puzzle Book, which is a book of mathematical recreations published in the Soviet Union in the early 1950s. And it's been translated into English by Penguin, but what's brilliant about it is not only are these mathematical puzzles so tricky, but they also tell you how to be an ideal Soviet citizen at the same time. Puzzle. Vitya pledges his brigade of pioneers will plant half as many fruit trees as the other pioneers. Kiryusha pledges his brigade, the best of the detachment, will match the trees of all brigades together, including Vitya's. Their brigades work the last shift simultaneously. The preceding brigades of the detachment plant 40 trees. Both pledges are fulfilled exactly. How many trees does the whole detachment plant? Answer: a kind of Latin, finished and intricate, or a box of glass plate negatives from 1887, unearthed by accident of Newcastle Cloth Market. The oceanic white-tip shark. Ectoplasm. Natasha Ivanova on her collective farm, working out the most efficient way to harvest cotton. I don't know if any of you got this, but the actual answer is 136. Poem for my daughter now, seeing as I read one for my son. So this is after Robert Pinsky's poem Daughter, which is just a series of very short-lined little moments in sequence. Daughter, after Robert Pinsky. One. She wakes at 7 a.m., her internal clock unstintingly accurate, and can sleep 12 hours at a stretch without losing hold of her last thought. The grievance she fell asleep with, you didn't get me rice milk, or you didn't sing me song about Tommy Thumb, her dawn declaration. Though she'll also ask, is it morning? Just to check she hasn't missed the best and purest portion of her day, the bit with her brother and breakfast in it, by being away. Two. The dresses and tops in her wardrobe smell of fabric conditioner, sugar, vanilla, baking soda, and are frequently washed. The clothes she hurries off and leaves in heaps on stairs and sofas so she can flash about the house with nothing on, a moon pale, decelerating balloon. Recall whiskey, layered, earthy, consisting of neither sweat nor excrement, but of what her deeper body's left behind itself in warmth. I cannot tell the strands of it apart. Cut off by the Atlantic, half her family are permanently absent, though she hasn't noticed this yet. Her world is still the roof over Sif in the Japanese pictograph. Her fiercest non-human attachments are to vibrantly coloured objects, orange plate, red fork, she cannot eat without. She's learning this house like a Sam. The crack in the kitchen sink, the drawers and all their warring contents, the geography of each room immutable as television. When visitors come, she's keen to show them the most horrific thing she knows. Reen Portfleet's picture of a snot gurgle from the Bantam Book of Gnomes. Scabrous, radically lopsided, huge. He's forcing a gnome through a mangle while his sidekick black rat laughs. The book falls open at his face. She might be Persephone, bravely showing off what she's survived, but it's probably the snot she's more delighted by, the viscous, glittering rivulets he hasn't wiped away. In Timothy Leary's eight-circuit system of human evolution, there's a drug for every stage. Acquiring language or the symbol state, concerning itself with maps and artifacts, is mimicked by amphetamines, crystal meth, benzedrine. Silent too long as an infant, our daughter talks all day. Her toys, her toes, her pictures, her minutely attenuated hierarchy of friends. Like a businessman on the last train home after one too many espressos, selling you his dream. Vanity Fair. Dearest William, I could begin by hoping you are well in England, and I do, now that the Nth Regiment has returned to Chatham. Or I could begin by telling you that reports of worsening weather here are true, that Georgie thinks you wicked and unkind for leaving him that your former servants pine, or that father, though no better, is no worse, etc. But this is not a weather talk sort of letter. It is after 3. The whole house sleeps, even Becky. And I am kept awake 6 weeks by your crippling absence. An irony, I confess, since for all your years of passionate presence, I failed to cherish you. Now that you're gone, Becky, and you were right about her all along, keeps dreadful company. Boorish men who jest and drink and flirt, and she isn't in the slightest shocked by any of it. I keep to my room. I have placed the portrait of George face down on the dresser. I have folded the gloves you left in an innermost drawer. as though they were a gift. Since you spoke of my incapacity for love, I have come to see how my own fierce widowhood was a shell against the world, a kind of carapace made up of pride, stupidity, and cowardice, a stay, if you will, against the kind of attachment such as yours for me deserved. Poor shredded raiment, for if it did not keep me warm, it kept me safe, safe against you and safe against myself. Last year, at the opera, it was Dido and Aeneas. I wished to take your hand in a sudden, artless, harmless way that would not give you pause, then didn't. I think I must have sensed the charge built up from a decade's loving in your fingers, though there you sat, as solid as an anchor, and feared that touching it would knock me flat. Now I'm scared I shall die without it. Dear Dobbin, come back. Like everything else we do in our mingled, muddy lives, this letter is overdue. Forgive me if my love arrives belatedly, but there is a ship can get you here by Friday, and come all the rain in Christendom, I shall be waiting for you by the viewing platform. Dearest William, put out to sea. Yours, Amelia Sedley. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a reading by Irish poets Sinead Morrissey and Mary O'Donoghue, presented by the Poetry Reading Series at the College of General Studies and co-sponsored by the Center for the Humanities. Tonight's moderator was Boston University Associate Professor of Humanities, Meg Tyler. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 800-909-9287. That's 800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Paul Kalo. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydonis. I'm Steve Brown. Thanks for joining us.